Hello, everybody, and welcome to another Recovery Radio broadcast recorded live at the Leyta Recovery Center in downtown Moscow. Recovery Radio is an outreach of the Leyta Recovery Center, located at 531 South Main Street in Moscow. You can contact the LRC by phone at 208-883-1045 or by email at leytarecoverycenter@gmail.com. You can find them on the web at leytarecoverycenter.org and on Facebook.
Recovery Radio's purpose is to share with our community how recovery from addiction and mental health issues affect us all, to make our community aware of the recovery resources available in our area, and to share the personal stories of people in and around recovery, highlighting their experiences, insight, and hope for continuing in recovery. My name is Denise, and I am a grateful and recovering addict and a grateful believer in Jesus. And who are you?
Who am I? Yeah. Well, I am Radio Johnny, and I am a grateful recovered alcoholic, recovered from a seemingly hopeless state of mind and body. So today, in the studio, pseudo studio, with us is Doug from Moscow. Welcome, Doug. Good to see you here.
Hi, Johnny. Hi, hey. Denise. Glad to be welcome. Here.
In full disclosure, Doug and I have known each other for many years through a past life and employment history. And Doug has agreed to come down here today and talk to us a little bit about his recovery and where he's going from here. So, Doug, I'm going to toss it over to you, and why don't you tell us a little bit about your experience, strength, and hope? Maybe a little history first for people to get to know you.
Sure. Yeah, I'll start from the beginning. Oddly enough, when I was in the sixth grade, and it's something that sticks in my mind, when I was in the sixth grade, I remember having some kind of an official coming to our classroom and talk about whatever it was, but he mentioned that one out of three people in this room will be addicted to alcohol at some point in the future. And I knew the alcoholic mind that I have, I knew that that was me, but moved forward. I think the first time that I ever took a drink on purpose, I was at home by myself. I was a sophomore in high school and I was getting ready to go to work, and my parents had gone someplace with the rest of the family and left me there by myself. And I thought, this is a great time for me to see what scotch tasted like, because it always sounded like it tasted good, So I went into my parents' closet and got their scotch out. And oddly enough, the story of Jim in the Big Book always made me laugh, because I mixed the scotch with milk.
Oh, there you go. Yeah.
And of course, it tasted horribly. So I thought, well, I better try some of the other kinds of liquor. Maybe it'll be better, So by the time that I finished with this little experiment, I probably had maybe a half a dozen shots of, I really don't know. And I had no idea what it would do to me, because I had never done this before. So I finished up and put everything away, and I started walking to work. And of course, the effect came as I'm walking down the street. And by the time I got to work, I was just out of it, But that was my first experience with alcohol. And of course, that's kind of like the catch-22, right? And now I've had it, and it's the one thing that I wanted to go back to every time I could. And reflecting on my life, that's basically what my life was like for the next 38 years, was making it possible for me to go and drink. I was fortunate enough, I guess, to never get in trouble. I always had a job. I always had money and cars and houses, but that was the one purpose for my life, was just to be able to drink as much as I wanted to without getting in trouble. So in the early 70s, of course, the Vietnam War was going on, and I graduated from high school, and having to deal with the draft back in those days, I enlisted in the Navy so that I wouldn't have to go over to Vietnam and I could stay out in the water, instead of being in the jungle. But the Navy or the military is a great place for an alcoholic to practice, because it's a culture. They want you to drink, they like to drink, and so I got a lot of practice there, and fortunately, the people around me who were my superiors, were able to keep me out of trouble. But I pretty much drank as much as I wanted to. I did get married at that period in time. Of course, that relationship didn't work very well, and I sort of cast out my wife and my young daughter. And you know, I live with that guilt even today. But it's something that happened probably because I'm just an alcoholic, and I, you know, that's the kind of life that I live. They were in my way, so to speak. But after and of course I went overseas on aircraft carriers, and you know, I was picked up by the shore patrol, laying passed out on the sidewalk in Hong Kong and in the Philippines and in Korea and many of the places that we went to for port. You know, I mean, to spend weeks and weeks and weeks out at sea without drinking, and then of course I had to make up for that during the times we were in port. You know. And rather than enjoying the world like that, I chose to go off and drink as much as possible and miss out on all of that stuff. But you know, that's the way we live. And then I got out of the service in the 80s and lived in Spokane for a while. My second wife was sort of an enabler. She, you know, allowed me to drink as much as I wanted to, and she would just take care of me. You know, got me home, made sure I got to bed. And manage the money, you know, that, of course, that relationship didn't last very long either. And then I took a job in Wisconsin, which living up in the North Woods in Wisconsin, I bought a house. I was single, lived by myself. I lived in this little house out in the woods on a lake. I'm totally isolated from, you know, everybody. So, you know, what a great fertile place for an alcoholic to just be and do what he wants, what he needs to do. And
that's, oh, absolutely. You know, yeah, sounds like a dream to me.
Oh yeah, it was. Yeah. I mean, you know,
and no accountability and isolation.
And I had a great job, which didn't require me to do what the job was more or less kind of like, it was a Navy contractor. So we more or less were just there as firemen. So we sat around for 8 hours a day and until something broke, which was very seldom. And then we had to rush and do it. But you know, I could go there hungover, and come home, and on the way home I could stop at the local stores or bars or whatever and buy alcohol and drink it on the way home and drink as much. I mean, you know, it was just a place for me to just drink and be away from everything. And that went on for, you know, about 12 years. And I became an everyday drinker. There were occasions when I wouldn't drink for a day because I just had to recover, you know. But as soon as I started feeling better, I mean, I would get right after it again. I did get a DUI there, but the penalties for DUIs up there were not as severe as they are here, or, you know, it was easier to just get away with it. I did lose my license for a little while. But anyway, and then that contract ended, so I had to come back to civilization. And Spokane being my home, I came back, and all roads led to the job that Johnny and I worked at. And about a little less than a year after getting into that job and being in the real world, I, of course, got into legal trouble. And you know, what happened was, it was the 3rd of July. The next day was a holiday, so a bunch of friends and I were down at the, you know, my office tavern, you know, over in Pullman, and you know, I got fallen off a bar stool drunk, and the friends that I worked with, you know, put me in a cab and got me home. But I left my car down there at the parking lot across the street. And, you know, being crazy drunk, I just said, I've got to go get my car. So I walked from my apartment all the way down to the office tavern and got in my car and started driving it home. And I made it about 4 blocks, and the police pulled me over. So I got a DUI, that was pretty much the bottom for me. I was tired of it, and I realized that, you know, this is getting me in trouble, and I need to do something about it. And I went to see a lawyer, who is John Hart, who is now the judge over in Whitman County.
Right.
And fortunately, you know, being at the right place at the right time, he was talking on the phone with somebody, another client, while I was in there talking with him. And He mentioned to this guy about the deferred prosecution plan that Washington State has, and so I asked him about it, and John said, well, I don't recommend that to people because it's very difficult, and it's most people don't have success with it. And what it means is you have to stay sober for 5 years. But you're not going to be able to beat this DUI rap, and you're going to have to go to court and blah, blah, blah. You know. And so I asked him about the deferred prosecution, and he said, well, I can submit the paperwork and get you qualified for it. But, like I said, it's difficult to do. Can you stay sober for 5 years? You know, and I thought, well, I can try. So he got me into the deferred prosecution plan. And, of course, I had to go to IOP and have the breathalyzer in my car and go to AA meetings, of course. That's a requirement. And do counseling for a couple of years. My counselor at the recovery center over there in Pullman said to me afterwards, many years afterwards, she goes, you're the poster child for the deferred prosecution plan. Because you went to AA, and you haven't drank since then. And so the plan worked perfectly for you. So that's basically what happened to me, and that's what made me stop drinking and start going to Alcoholics Anonymous and go to counseling for a lot of other things, which we can talk about later. So that's basically what happened to me. That was where I hit the bottom and decided that I needed to surrender and ask for help. And fortunately, I ran into the right people. I had the right counselor, and I found the right sponsor, and I got in with the right AA group. It was like being home, very much like, that first drink of alcohol made me feel like I was home, and I had found something that really made me feel whole again. When I got to AA and the first meeting that I went to, I thought, this is where I need to be. I felt like I'm at home. These people definitely understand me because I know their stories. We had the first step meeting, and they all talked about their problems and their stories, and they all laughed and had a good time with it. And I thought, this is where I need to be. Maybe I can actually do this. And I was able to stay sober for the 5 years. And oddly enough, I got the letter in the mail saying that you've completed the deferred prosecution plan, so you're off the hook. The DUI has been removed from your records. And oddly enough, the alcoholic in me thought, I can start drinking now.
Of course.
Yeah, of course, I can start drinking. And the thing is that I actually thought about it, But I'll tell you, I don't want to be that person that I was before. I'm happy with my life the way it is. It turned out far better than I ever anticipated that it would, and just like they promised. And so basically that's what happened to me and what it's like now. I've been sober for 14 years this past August, which was just last month. My life is far better than I ever anticipated it would be. I'm retired now, and I'm moving to Tucson, and I have a relationship that works for me. It's a wonderful person that I love being with. I have lots of friends. I'm sorry that I'm going to have to leave the area, but I know that in the program I'll be able to make new friends down there, and things will be great, and I don't have to take a drink. So that's my story, and that's what happened, and that's what it's like for me now.
Great. Yeah. I hear all the time in AA from different people is AA is the only program in the world where you can walk into a meeting 3,000 miles from home, walk in, see a bunch of strangers, and immediately start reminiscing.
Right. Yes.
There's all so much of the same story.
Yes.
I just got to say congratulations, and isn't it so much better on this side? Being in recovery and living in this life is good.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Absolutely. I wouldn't trade it for anything. And, I've always thought that, everything that happened to me, I drank for 38 years of my life, and it was all to bring me to this point. I live my life from day to day, and today is where I'm supposed to be. Mm-hmm. I'm supposed to be here with you and sharing my story with people for whatever purpose that has. But,
Absolutely.
I'm glad to be here.
Well, fantastic. You know, there are things in your story that, you know, kind of strike a chord with me. The isolation. I found that employment really got in the way of my drinking. And whether it was absolutely intentional or not, I left, and I'm being generous to myself, at the tip of somebody's boot, you know, several jobs, so that I didn't have that, you know, worry hanging over me. You know, it's kind of funny. It's like the unemployment department doesn't care if you're drunk or sober. They just want to see the paperwork that you've been applying for jobs. But you can drink right through that. And, you know, there's certain people that if you've got some skills, are just willing to overlook the fact that you may or may not show up on any given day. And, and I could just isolate and drink the way I wanted to. Mm-hmm. You know, I was fortunate enough that my relationship was hanging by a thread, but evidently I got sober in time to save that. You know, that was not my part of the story, but I'm sure the same pain was involved, you know, on both sides through all that. So, yeah, it's, you know, really important that people can look and see that it's not just putting the alcohol in your body that makes the alcoholic. It's that whole, you know, why do I live? I live to drink, or, you know, people are just constantly messing with me. You know, a normal person gets a DUI and says, I shouldn't have had that last drink. And an alcoholic gets a DUI and says, I should have taken a different route home.
Yeah, exactly.
So, you know, understanding how, you know, the alcoholic mind works. I mean, we spent last week talking about how the alcoholic brain works and the addicted brain, and that was pretty fascinating. But the brain doesn't automatically, I mean, the brain makes you, your heart beat automatically, your lungs go in and out automatically, and keeps the liver and all the other organs functioning automatically.
Yeah, but there's some neuroscience.
It doesn't point your car towards the liquor store.
It enjoys the dopamine and the serotonin and all those things that we get from either healthy things or unhealthy things. Yeah, that was good stuff.
Yeah, it was interesting.
So, it's kind of switching gears a little bit, if you're ready for me to do that. So,
absolutely.
I just thought it was really cool, and you know, because personally, I understand that with health thing and being able to, you know, get through those years. I myself did the same kind of a thing here as a two-year program. And so what now in recovery, you know, today and over the past handful of years are some things that help keep you still sober?
Well, I go to meetings. I mean, I don't go to daily meetings, but I still go to meetings. Over the last year and a half, I've realized how much I missed that. But I had the tools and the ability to get through. Now getting back to meetings is really nice. I you know, seeing people like Johnny. I hadn't seen Johnny for a year and a half, probably maybe even 2 years. I think one of the other things that really has benefited me, and something I'd like to say to people in recovery, is that the one thing that I have learned to appreciate the most about Alcoholics Anonymous and what it did for me was alcohol being the symptom of what's really wrong with me. And having done the fifth step with my sponsor many years ago allowed me to realize how beneficial it was to be honest about the way I thought and the things that I did. And so when I went to a counselor, I was able to work on Doug, you know, without the alcohol being in the way, you know, because then I was able to go there and talk about things that bothered me, like the guilt about my first wife and child, and to deal with that and to get that out in the open and make amends for it, you know, although I don't know how a person can make amends for that. It's a lifetime thing, but it's allowed me to work on, you know, the other things in my life that caused me to drink, or, you know, that drinking sort of alleviated the pain and the suffering. and the ability to be, you know, perfectly honest with everybody about everything, but still be polite. I like telling my my wife. I'll say my wife, although we're not really married, but we've been living together for a while. It's just easier that way. I heard someone say that when you tell the truth, you never have to remember anything, right?
Yes.
Because that tangled web isn't there, you know?
Yeah, that tangled web so, we weave when so first we practice to deceive. That one. Yeah.
Sounds familiar.
My grandma told me that one. It's good.
When she asked me if I remember something, I might. But, you know, I tell the truth all the time, so I don't have to remember things. But that's a great way to live, you know, to learn to be honest. And that's probably the thing that I benefited the most from being sober and being able to work on the other problems that I have. Like, I have this relationship now with her that there's no resentment anymore. If there is a resentment, I deal with it immediately and get rid of it. And because that was something that I carried around tremendously. I think, you know, all alcoholics or addicts do. You know, they live in that resentment life, living in the past, living in the future, never living today. You know, so I have honesty, resent-free, and living for the moment are the two things that make me feel happy, joyous, and free. Mm-hmm. You know, I hate the cliche, but it's there. To go back to your question, I think just going to meetings and trying to use those tools that they taught us that I've learned in the program is what's kept me going. And the realization that I'm the happiest that I've ever been. You know, especially now I don't have to work.
And, yeah. Work.
You know, I got sober, you know, in time to be able to save the money that would allow me to live, you know, a nice lifestyle, you know, without working. That's what keeps me going. And now I have a lot of time to, you know, to visit with my friends and go to more meetings, you know, be of service. That's what keeps me going.
That's awesome. Tell me about that. What do you like to do to be of service?
Well, for many years, the last year and a half, I really haven't done anything as far as service work goes. But in the years prior to that, my sponsor, you know, when he finished reading the first 164 pages to me, you know, I like to say he kicked me out the door and he said, "Go be of service to somebody." And you know, he was a counselor at the college, so he was able to direct me to young people and people that he knew that needed help. So he would tell me, you know, go over and pick this kid up and take him to a meeting, you know, or go play racquetball with him or something, you know, and be his friend. And then I started doing service work for my home group. I was the treasurer and then the alt GSR and the GSR. And I was the alt DCM for the district here for a while. And I was one of the committee chairs. I really loved going to the assemblies for our area because if you can appreciate a room full of 100 alcoholics trying to do business, it's something that you have to see to appreciate.
Like 100 Johnnies in there? Is that what we're talking about?
That's exactly right.
Probably even worse than that, yeah.
But it's it's a wonderful thing to see, you know. I mean, but these people are trying and they're being of service, and you've got to give them a lot of respect for trying to do it. And they do, they keep things going for the new guy, and that's what it's all about, right? So, but since I retired, which was last January, I basically stopped doing service work because I wanted to be sort of free and to be able to travel, but the pandemic came, and so all of that got kind of shut down. So I really haven't been doing a lot of service work in the last, you know, rotation. And I hadn't been going to meetings, but it's something that I'm going to get back to doing because, well, it's something that I really liked to do.
Yeah, it sounds like you got really involved in different areas and aspects of it. That's awesome.
I did. I liked going to the business meetings and like I say, the area assemblies were. I enjoyed there. I could go and see people that I don't see, but once every 6 months, mm-hmm. right?
I just pictured a lot of fun people like Johnny there, all together. Kind of like, you know, when
my group of
NA / you know, CR people get together and we have fun things. We do like hula hoop competitions and, you know, water sports and fun well, stuff. And I realized that you guys were talking about a meeting, but still it was fun, right?
Right.
You know,
so. Well, yeah. The assemblies and those big meetings, it's interesting because, well, it says in the Alcoholics Anonymous, the what we call the big book, that, you know, we're people from, you know, basically a range of experience and that would not normally get together. That doesn't mean we necessarily always leave our egos at the door. Mm-hmm. So,
well, 100
alcoholics, 100 alcoholics in a room together trying to make a decision is interesting
it
to
is.
Watch.
It is.
Because you'll hear 99 arguments one way versus 99 arguments the other way. And some people will argue both sides of it just because it's that confusing.
Mm-hmm.
And all over maybe something as simple as, should we submit a change to the General Service Office in New York of something in the big book, you know, to delete a story or add a story or something like that.
Yes.
It can be right. a real three-ring circus. But, you know, ultimately, it's wonderful the way the AA organization works. Because it's not a top-down organization. The General Service Office does not say, we're changing this, and everybody, you all down below us, you know, in all your groups and meetings, you're going to have to abide by this new thing. No, it comes from the bottom up. It's the meetings that share something with the group, and the group takes it to the district. The district, if they agree on it, takes it to the assembly. Assembly likes it, they take it all the way up to the GSO. And, you know, at any point along there, it can also be kicked back down to the previous one with a concern. That gets addressed, and then it moves up. So basically, it allows the GSO to literally behave like maybe our federal government should, which is, what can we do for you?
Right.
You tell us what you want, and we'll facilitate it.
Right. Yeah, an example, you know, trying to change a sentence, you know, in one of the pamphlets, you know, I remember commenting to one of the older guys in the group. I said, you know, it's going to take 2 years to get this thing changed. He said, yeah, and what's your hurry?
Yeah.
So it's slow, but you know, the group conscience comes out eventually. I mean, I've gone to assemblies where we had made a decision to do something in the whole group. The majority of a group at an assembly decided they were going to do that. And one guy got up and spoke in opposition. One person got up and spoke in opposition. And it changed the mind of everybody in the assembly. So
it's pretty powerful.
It is. It is. Mm-hmm. So that minority opinion does work if you see it in action.
And it does matter. Yeah it does matter.
It does matter.
So I was just wondering if there's anything that you would think would be good to share as far as if someone's new in recovery or thinking about getting into recovery, any little tidbits that you would like to share.
We share, you know, this program goes out to the, you know, greater Palouse area, Moscow, Pullman on a good day, Lewiston, the orchards, you know, way out there. I'm reasonably sure, just based on government statistics, that there are people in what might be referred to as contemplation of recovery or even pre-contemplation. You know, those poor bastards that don't know that they have a problem yet. Or
denial,
or just,
you know,
working
yeah,
on a problem,
I mean, yeah.
problem now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, I know that for myself, you know, I like to say this about the first step, you know, that I knew that I was powerless over alcohol, but, you know, as an old timer once said, I lived underneath that dash for the next part, and that my life is unmanageable, you know. So I knew that I was powerless over alcohol a long time ago, but I just didn't know what to do about it. And not knowing anything about recovery or what should you do about it and what's the solution. And the idea of not ever drinking again was just out of the question. But I can say that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous worked for me. It allowed me to understand a little bit more about the spiritual side of life, which was definitely a benefit. Also, I didn't mention that before. Having removed that alcohol and understanding a little bit more about the spiritual part of it, you know, even though you know, some of these things are not approved by Alcoholics Anonymous, my sponsor was able to direct me to some reading and some studying about spirituality, and you know, a lot of times we don't really think of that, but I was able to understand some spirituality away from religion. That's something that I was never able to grasp in my younger days, but Alcoholics Anonymous sort of helped me to understand the spiritual side of my life, and you know, like I said, having had a spiritual awakening, mm-hmm. you know, I was able to be of service to other people, and find a way to be happy without drinking. If you want to explore those things and you want to figure out if you are an alcoholic, come to a meeting and talk with some people who are alcoholics, and if you understand what they're saying, then you know, then maybe you should consider that as a path if it's something that you want to do. You know, I'm not going to say I don't recommend counseling. They say that these recovery centers, you spend thousands of dollars going to recovery centers to find out that Alcoholics Anonymous is free.
Right, exactly.
and you know, and I did that, but I was sort of mandated by the law to do that. Mm-hmm. I'm not saying that I didn't appreciate the outpatient treatment program that I went to. I did learn a lot of things there, like you said, you know, the chemistry in your brain and how you fit into the family structure and all of these kinds of things. One of the things that I'm probably getting off subject here, but
that's fine.
One of the things that I do remember from watching a film in recovery or in the IOP program that I was at, there was a scientist or a psychologist or something said that the 20th century will probably be remembered for the 12-step program more than anything that has happened in this century. You know, that's not awesome. Atomic power, but the 12-step program and that ability to clean house, you know, and move forward and learn to be outside of yourself is probably something that has benefited us most. And if you want to, whatever your problem is, whether it's sex or drugs or alcohol or overeating, you know, this is a way to get in touch with yourself and eliminate that from your, you know, from your life and help others to recover from the same problem. And that in itself has made me really, really a happy person.
Well, and that really is the key. I mean, in the 12 steps, you know, step two, came to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me insanity. And step three, turn your will and your life over to the care of God as you understand him. Mm-hmm. It doesn't say the biblical God. It doesn't say Allah. It doesn't say, you know, a local preacher. It doesn't say any of that. It says a God is of your understanding. So, you know, and even specifically in the book says, we don't discount what, you know, religious people believe because we know we're not the only path to recovery. And we mm-hmm. don't believe that, you know, what they're saying is necessarily wrong. Mm-hmm. It works for some people, you know, some people in this room.
I was going to say, I think the 12-step, you know, just living life that way is helpful in everyday life mm-hmm. in all aspects. I myself have, man, just found freedom by working those steps in all sorts of areas, honestly. Right. I mean, in every aspect, by living that way, by interacting with my family and my community in that way has helped me grow so much and change
right.
and heal and find freedom. Oh, it's been great, really.
Well, you know, there's somebody who is out there and is you know, questioning whether or not this is something they could do. I was asking in several meetings, you know, what did you do to get sober? You know, the short answer is I went to a meeting, I got a sponsor, and I did what I was told.
Right.
Now, for me, that's the steps. I didn't really believe in what I was doing was going to get me sober. But as Johnny said, you know, after a while, I came to believe that this is really working. I feel better. I'm happy. You know, I found a way to keep myself sober for 6 months. You know, like, oh my gosh, I've never done that before. So I came to believe it. So, you know, you can go to whatever meeting it is that you want to go to and find somebody who has done it before and do what they tell you to do.
Right.
And if you don't think it's going to work for you, you can just leave. There's no obligation. There's no contract. You know, these are simply suggestions, and they work for a lot of people. Some people they don't work for, and then there are other people who don't do what they're told, and they end up falling off the wagon, so to speak, or end up in jail again,
or dead.
I mean, there's that.
For an alcoholic like me, to drink again is a for sure death sentence.
Yeah,
it will kill me. Yeah. I mean, that's all there is to it. It's not sad. It's not, oh, well. It's just the way my brain works. Once I start pouring alcohol on it, it's going to demand more and more and more until I die of, you know, cirrhosis of the liver or walk out in front of a bus.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe if I was lucky, I'd just be institutionalized, you know, be in a vegetative state, you know, in a hospital somewhere being kept alive through a feeding tube until, you know, the rest of my body finally broke down. But
see, and that's kind of the thing is, like, you know, what you're saying about just following what people are telling you to do. I mean, humbling yourself enough to realize, you know, I'll just speak for myself. Here I was on this path for like 15 years and making totally destructive decisions. Got into an outpatient program, did what they told me to do. And voila, just trying something different and understanding that there were so many people around me to help me and people who had been through this and just being willing to trust them.
Mm-hmm.
Just surrendering, being willing to trust.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That surrender part, that's you know, a word that a lot of people are afraid of,
but when
I look at surrender, I look at the fact that I can stop fighting everything and everyone.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm surrendering my self-will over the world to have a little bit of a better life, and it's actually much better.
Much better.
'Cause as hard as I tried to control the world, it refused to listen to me.
Yes. You know, it reminded me of a story that you remember a TV show called West Wing, and this was a story that was told in there by somebody who was an alcoholic in the show, and he was talking to another young man who was having some problems. And this story just really rang true. I mean, I saw this episode probably in my first year of sobriety, and it just, boom, it just hit home, and I've never forgotten it. Yeah, and it was season 2, episode 10. I can almost tell you exactly what it is, but the man was telling a story about a guy was walking down the street, and he fell into this very deep hole, right? And it was very deep, and he couldn't figure out, he couldn't climb out of this hole. So he was just standing down there wondering what to do, and a priest walked by, and he said, "Father, I've fallen in this hole. I really don't know what to do to get out of it." And the priest took out a piece of paper, and he wrote a prayer on it, and he threw it down in the hole. And the guy took the prayer, and he looked at it, and he put it in his pocket. And then a few minutes later, a doctor walked by, his doctor, and he said, "Doctor, I've fallen in this hole, and I can't find my way out of it. I can't crawl out." And the doctor took out his prescription pad and wrote a prescription on it and threw it down in the hole. And the guy looked at the prescription and put it in his pocket. And a few minutes later, one of his friends walked by, and he said, "Joe, I've fallen in this hole, and I can't climb out of it." And Joe jumped in the hole with him. And the guy was stunned. He said, "Joe, why did you jump down the hole with me? What are we going to do?" He goes, and Joe told him, he says, "Well, I've been in this hole before, and I know how to get out of it. Just follow me."
Boom.
But,
boom.
I love that. I love that story.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah.
Because it's so true.
That story just, I was sitting there, and I'm just, boom, it just, the light came on right then. You know, this is why I'm in this program and why I need to do what I'm told. And 14 years now, it's worked.
That's right. Some people say they're suggestions, and I mean, that really just leaves it up to the individual's willingness to take the suggestion and run with it. My first sponsor was the same way. You know, he told me what I needed to do. He basically said, here's how it is. If you do what I tell you to do, there's a good chance you'll stay sober. Mm-hmm. If you don't do what I tell you to do, you're probably going to drink again. Mm-hmm. And I'm like, any other options? He's like, nope.
Exactly.
Nope, I don't think so. Exactly. And so I did what he told me to do, you know, and it wasn't always comfortable. And it wasn't always what I thought had anything to do with staying sober. You know, I didn't know how washing ashtrays after a meeting or stacking chairs was going to keep me sober. But you know what? My hands were busy for a half an hour more than the meeting lasted. Mm-hmm. And then I started shaking hands at the front, and that added another half an hour, 45 minutes to time I was in a place that was safe, surrounded by people who loved me when I could not love myself. Because they understood where I was.
The washing ashtrays and stacking chairs reminds me of exercise. Sometimes I don't want to do it, but I sure feel a lot better afterwards.
Right.
I told a fellow the other night, he said, yeah, you know, I really didn't think I was going to come to the meeting tonight. And I said, well, my rule is there's only two times I have to go to a meeting. That's when I want to. And when I don't want to,
right?
Exactly. And yep. That's how it works. Well, we are just about up against the clock here, Doug. And, you know, I just want to say, first of all, thank you for being a friend. I look forward to keeping in touch with you once you get down to greater outer Tucson. And I hope you find it just awful and come back. But barring that.
I doubt he's going to find Arizona's awful.
Yeah. Oh, you're an ex-Arizona
yeah,
too,
you're going to love
you?
It. Oh, it'll be a great time.
Yes. I'm surrounded. Yeah. And thank you so much for coming in today and sharing this.
You're welcome. Thanks for having me.
This will live on in infamy, as they say.
Oh, no.
And no doubt come back to haunt you.
Thank you, Doug, for coming on and talking and sharing your story. It's awesome.
Welcome. I'm glad to do it.
And thank you, Denise, for another great week. And I'm going to close like I always do and say, you know, if you think you have a problem with drugs or alcohol or mental health issues, you do.